Dale don't want to talk to nobody right now, Sunny said. That's 'cause she tired of it, Day grumbled. They always asking questions and things. She keep giving out information and not getting nothing. They don't even give her a postcard. Yep, Sunny said. That's right. All they wants to do is know everything. And that's what Miss Rebecca wants, too. So go on, Daddy. Tell her. Just get this over with. But Day didn't want to talk about Henrietta's life. First I heard about it was she had that cancer, he said, repeating the story he'd told dozens of reporters over the years, almost verbatim. Hopkins called me, said, come up there, 'cause she died. They asked me to let them have Henrietta, and I told them no. I said, I don't know what you did, but you killed her. Don't keep cutting on her. But after a time, my cousin said it wouldn't hurt none, so I said okay. Day clenched his three remaining teeth. I didn't sign no papers, he said. I just told them they could do autopsy. Nothing else. Them doctors never said nothing about keeping her alive in no tubes or growing no cells. All they told me was they wanted to do autopsy, see if they could help my children. And I've always just knowed this much. They is the doctor, and you got to go by what they say. I don't know as much as they do. And them doctors said if I gave them my old lady, they could use her to study that cancer and maybe help my children, my grandchildren. Yeah, Sonny yelled. They said it would help his kids in case they come down with cancer. He had 5 kids. What was he gonna do? They knew them cells was already growing when I come down there after she died, Day said, shaking his head. But they didn't tell me nothing about that. They just asked if they could cut her up, see about that cancer. Well, what do you expect from Hopkins? Babette yelled from the kitchen, where she sat watching a soap opera. I wouldn't even go there to get my toenails cut. Mm-hmm, Day yelled back, thumping his silver cane on the floor like an exclamation point. Back then, they did things, Sonny said, especially to black folks. John Hopkins was known for experimenting on black folks. They'd snatch 'em off the street. That's right, Babette said, appearing in the kitchen door with her coffee. Everybody knows that. They just snatch 'em off the street, Sonny said. Snatching people, Babette yelled, her voice growing louder. Experimenting on them, Sonny yelled. You'd be surprised how many people disappeared in East Baltimore when I was a girl, Babette said, shaking her head. I'm telling you, I lived here in the 50s when they got Henrietta, and we weren't allowed to go anywhere near Hopkins. When it got dark and we were young, we had to be on the steps, or Hopkins might get us. The Laxes aren't the only ones who heard from a young age that Hopkins and other hospitals abducted black people. Since at least the 1800s, black oral history has been filled with tales of night doctors who kidnapped black people for research. And there were disturbing truths behind those stories. Some of the stories were conjured by white plantation owners taking advantage of the long-held African belief that ghosts cause disease and death. To discourage slaves from meeting or escaping, slave owners told tales of gruesome research done on black bodies, then covered themselves in white sheets and crept around at night, posing as spirits coming to infect black people with disease or steal them for research. Those sheets eventually gave rise to the white hooded cloaks of the Ku Klux Klan. But night doctors weren't just fictions conjured as scare tactics. Many doctors tested drugs on slaves and operated on them to develop new surgical techniques, often without using anesthesia. Fear of night doctors only increased in the early 1900s as black people migrated north to Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, and news spread that medical schools there were offering money in exchange for bodies. Black corpses were routinely exhumed from graves for research, and an underground shipping industry kept schools in the north supplied with black bodies from the south for anatomy courses. The bodies sometimes arrived, a dozen or so at a time, in barrels labeled turpentine. Because of this history, black residents near Hopkins have long believed the hospital was built in a poor black neighborhood for the benefit of scientists, to give them easy access to potential research subjects. In fact, it was built for the benefit of Baltimore's poor. Johns Hopkins was born on a tobacco plantation in Maryland, where his father later freed his slaves nearly 60 years before emancipation. Hopkins made millions working as a banker and grocer, and selling his own brand of whiskey. But he never married and had no children. So in 1873, not long before his death, he donated $7 million to start a medical school and charity hospital. He wrote a letter to the 12 men he'd chosen to serve as its board of trustees, outlining his wishes. In it, he explained that the purpose of Hopkins Hospital was to help those who otherwise couldn't get medical care. "The indigent sick of this city and its environs, without regard to sex, age, or color, who require surgical or medical treatment, and who can be received into the hospital without peril to other inmates, and the poor of the city and state, of all races, who are stricken down by any casualty, shall be received into the hospital without charge." He specified that the only patients to be charged were those who could easily afford it, and that any money they brought in should then be spent treating those without money. He also set aside an additional $2 million worth of property and $20,000 in cash each year specifically for helping black children. "It will be your duty hereafter to provide suitable buildings for the reception, maintenance, and education of orphaned colored children. I direct you to provide accommodations for 300 or 400 children of this class. You are also authorized to receive into this asylum at your discretion, as belonging to such class, colored children who have lost one parent only, and, in exceptional cases, to receive colored children who are not orphans, but may be in such circumstances as to require the aid of charity." Hopkins died not long after writing that letter. His board of trustees, many of them friends and family, created one of the top medical schools in the country, and a hospital whose public wards provided millions of dollars in free care to the poor, many of them black. But the history of Hopkins Hospital certainly isn't pristine when it comes to black patients. In 1969, a Hopkins researcher used blood samples from more than 7,000 neighborhood children, most of them from poor black families, to look for a genetic predisposition to criminal behavior. The researcher didn't get consent. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit claiming the study violated the boys' civil rights and breached confidentiality of doctor-patient relationships by releasing results to state and juvenile courts. The study was halted, then resumed a few months later using consent forms. In the late 90s, two women sued Hopkins, claiming that its researchers had knowingly exposed their children to lead and hadn't promptly informed them when blood tests revealed that their children had elevated lead levels, even when one developed lead poisoning. The research was part of a study examining lead abatement methods, and all families involved were black. The researchers had treated several homes to varying degrees, then encouraged landlords to rent those homes to families with children so they could then monitor the children's lead levels. Initially, the case was dismissed. On appeal, one judge compared the study to Southam's HeLa injections, the Tuskegee study, and Nazi research, and the case eventually settled out of court. The Department of Health and Human Services launched an investigation and concluded that the study's consent forms failed to provide an adequate description of the different levels of lead abatement in the homes. But today, when people talk about the history of Hopkins's relationship with the Black community, the story many of them hold up as the worst offense is that of Henrietta Lacks, a Black woman whose body, they say, was exploited by white scientists. Sitting in Lawrence's living room, Sonny and Babette yelled back and forth for nearly an hour about Hopkins snatching Black people. Eventually, Sonny leaned back in his chair and said, "John Hopkins didn't give us no information about anything. That was the bad part. Not the sad part, but the bad part. 'Cause I don't know if they didn't give us information because they was making money out of it, or if they was just wanting to keep us in the dark about it. I think they made money out of it because they were selling her cells all over the world and shipping them for dollars." "Hopkins say they gave them cells away," Lawrence yelled. "But they made millions. It's not fair. She's the most important person in the world, and her family living in poverty. If our mother's so important to science, why can't we get health insurance?" Day had prostate cancer and asbestos-filled lungs. Sonny had a bad heart, and Deborah had arthritis, osteoporosis, nerve deafness, anxiety, and depression. With all that, plus the whole family's high blood pressure and diabetes, the Lackses figured they pretty much supported the pharmaceutical industry, plus several doctors. But their insurance came and went. Some were covered through Medicare, others on and off by spouses, but they all went stretches with no coverage or money for treatment. As the Lacks man talked about Hopkins and insurance, Babette snorted in disgust and walked to her recliner in the living room. "My pressure's going up, and I'm not going to die over this, you know?" The whole thing just wasn't worth getting riled up over, she said. But she couldn't help herself. Everybody knew Black people were disappearing because Hopkins was experimenting on them, she yelled. "I believe a lot of it was true." "Probably so," Sonny said. "A lot might have been a myth, too. You never know. But one thing we do know, them cells about my mother ain't no myth." Day thumped his cane again. "You know what is a myth?" Babette snapped from the recliner. "Everybody always saying Henrietta Lacks donated those cells. She didn't donate nothing. They took them and didn't ask." She inhaled a deep breath to calm herself. "What really would upset Henrietta is the fact that Dr. Guy never told the family anything. We didn't know nothing about those cells, and he didn't care. That just rubbed us the wrong way. I just kept asking everybody, why didn't they say anything to the family? They knew how to contact us. If Dr. Guy wasn't dead, I think I would have killed him myself." Chapter 22. The Fame She So Richly Deserves. 1970 to 1973. One afternoon in the late spring of 1970, George Guy stood in his favorite waders on the bank of the Potomac River, where he and several other Hopkins researchers had been fishing together every Wednesday for years. Suddenly, Guy was so exhausted he could hardly hold his fishing rod. His buddies dragged him up the embankment to the white Jeep he'd bought using money from a cancer research award. Soon after that fishing trip, at the age of 71, Guy learned he had the disease he'd spent his entire life trying to fight, and he had one of its most deadly forms, pancreatic cancer. If doctors didn't operate, Guy knew he would die within months. If they did, it might buy him a little time, or it might not. On August 8, 1970, around 6 a.m., Margaret called each member of the Guy Labs staff including a postdoctoral student who'd just flown in on a red-eye from Europe. "Come down to the lab as fast as you can," she told them. "There's going to be an emergency procedure this morning." She didn't tell them what that procedure would be. Before going into the operating room, George told his surgeons that he wanted them to take samples of his tumor, just as Dr. Wharton had done with Henrietta's tumor decades earlier. Guy gave his lab staff careful instructions for growing GG, a line of cancer cells taken from his pancreas. He hoped that his cells, like Henrietta's, would become immortal. "Work all day and night if you have to," he told his postdocs and assistants. "Make this happen." Soon, with Guy anesthetized on the operating table, surgeons opened him up and found that the cancer was inoperable. Growths covered his stomach, spleen, liver, and intestines. They worried that cutting into the cancer might kill him. Despite Guy's wishes, they sewed him up without taking any samples. When he awoke from anesthesia and found out there would be no GG line, he was furious. If this cancer was going to kill him, he wanted it to help advance science in the process. As soon as he'd recovered enough from his surgery to travel, Guy began contacting cancer researchers around the country, asking who was doing research on pancreatic cancer and needed a patient to experiment on. He was flooded with replies, some from scientists he didn't know, others from friends and colleagues. In the 3 months between his surgery and his death, Guy went to the Mayo Clinic in Minneapolis for a week of treatments with an experimental Japanese drug that made him violently ill. His son, George Jr., who had just finished medical school, sat with Guy through the whole thing and made sure he had a freshly pressed suit each day. After leaving the Mayo Clinic, Guy spent several days in New York City at Sloan Kettering for another study, and he underwent chemotherapy at Hopkins using a drug not yet approved for use in humans. Guy was 6.5 feet tall and about 215 pounds when he was diagnosed, but he withered quickly. He often doubled over from the abdominal pain, he vomited constantly, and the treatments soon left him confined to a wheelchair. But he continued showing up at the lab and writing letters to his colleagues. At some point, not long before his death, he told his former assistant, Mary Kupacek, that it was fine to release Henrietta's name if anyone asked, since it had been so many years. But Mary never told a soul. George Guy died on November 8, 1970. A few months after Guy's death, Howard Jones and several Hopkins colleagues, including Victor McCusick, a leading geneticist, decided to write an article about the history of the HeLa cell line as a tribute to Guy's career. Before writing the article, Jones pulled Henrietta's medical records to remind himself of the details of her case. When he saw the photographs of her biopsy, he immediately realized her tumor had been misdiagnosed. To be sure, he dug out the original biopsy sample, which had been stored on a shelf since 1951. In December 1971, when Jones and his colleagues published their tribute to Guy in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology, they reported that the original pathologist had misinterpreted and mislabeled Henrietta's cancer. Her tumor was invasive, but not an epidermoid carcinoma as originally diagnosed. Rather, the article said, it was a very aggressive adenocarcinoma of the cervix, meaning it originated from glandular tissue in her cervix instead of epithelial tissue. A misdiagnosis of this type was not uncommon at the time. In 1951, the same year Jones biopsied Henrietta's tumor, researchers from Columbia University reported that the two types of cancer were easily and often confused. According to Howard Jones and other gynecologic oncologists I talked with, the correct diagnosis wouldn't have changed the way Henrietta's cancer was treated. By 1951, at least 12 studies had found that cervical adenocarcinomas and epidermoid carcinomas responded the same to radiation, which was the treatment of choice for both types. Though it wouldn't have changed Henrietta's treatment, this new diagnosis could help explain why the cancer spread throughout her body so much faster than her doctors expected. Cervical adenocarcinomas are often more aggressive than epidermoid. Her syphilis, it turns out, could have been a factor as well. Syphilis can suppress the immune system and allow cancer to spread faster than normal. Regardless, Jones and his colleagues wrote, the new diagnosis was but a footnote to the abiding genius of George Guy. It has been often said that scientific discovery results when the right man is in the right place at the right time. Guy, they said, was precisely that man. And Hela was the result of that luck. If allowed to grow uninhibited under optimal cultural conditions, Hela would have taken over the world by this time, they wrote. The biopsy has secured for the patient, Henrietta Lacks as Hela, an immortality which has now reached 20 years. Will she live forever if nurtured by the hands of future workers? Even now, Henrietta Lacks, first as Henrietta and then as Hela, has a combined age of 51 years. This was the first time Henrietta's real name appeared in print. Along with it, for the first time, ran the now ubiquitous photograph of Henrietta standing with her hands on her hips. The caption called her Henrietta Lacks, Hela. With that publication, Henrietta's doctor and his colleagues forever linked Henrietta, Lawrence, Sonny, Deborah, Zakaria, their children, and all future generations of Lackses to the Hela cells and the DNA inside them. And Henrietta's identity would soon spread from lab to lab as quickly as her cells. Just 3 weeks after Henrietta's name was first published, Richard Nixon signed the National Cancer Act into law and launched the War on Cancer, designating $1.5 billion for cancer research over the next 3 years. In a move many believe was intended to distract attention from the Vietnam War, Nixon announced that scientists would cure cancer within 5 years, just in time for the United States bicentennial. With this new funding came intense political pressure for scientists to meet the president's deadline. Researchers raced to find what they believed to be the elusive cancer virus, with hopes of developing a vaccine to prevent it. And in May 1972, Nixon pledged that American and Russian scientists would work together in a biomedical exchange program to find the virus. Though much of the war on cancer hinged on research using cell cultures, few people knew that those cultures had been contaminated with Hela. A Washington Post reporter had been at the conference when Gartler announced the contamination problem. But he hadn't covered it, and most scientists were still denying that the problem existed. Some were even conducting studies aimed at disproving Gartler's findings. But the problem wasn't going to go away. Near the end of 1972, when Russian scientists claimed they'd found a cancer virus in cells from Russian cancer patients, the U.S. government had samples of the cells hand-delivered to the Naval Biomedical Research Laboratory in California for testing. It turned out those cells weren't from Russian cancer patients at all. They were from Henrietta Lacks. The man who discovered that fact was Walter Nelson Reese, a chromosome expert who was director of cell culture at the Naval Laboratory. Nelson Reese had been in the audience when Gartler presented his infamous research, and he was one of the few scientists who believed it. Nelson Reese had since been hired by the National Cancer Institute to help stop the contamination problem. He would become known as a vigilante who published Hela hit lists in Science, listing any contaminated lines he found, along with the names of researchers who'd given him the cells. He didn't warn researchers when he found that their cells had been contaminated with Hela. He just published their names, the equivalent of having a scarlet H pasted on your lab door. Despite all the evidence, most researchers still refused to believe there was a problem. And the media didn't seem to notice, until news hit that the Russian cells had been contaminated by American ones. Only then did newspapers in London, Arizona, New York, and Washington run headlines saying things like, "Cancer cells from long-dead woman invade other cultures." They reported serious confusion, misguided research, and millions of wasted dollars. Suddenly, for the first time since the Collier's article in the 50s, the press was very interested in the woman behind those cells. They wrote about her unusual kind of immortality in one article after another. They called her Helen Larson or Helen Lane, but never Henrietta Lacks, because Jones and McCusick had published her name in a small science journal few people read. Rumors spread about the identity of this mysterious Helen L. Some said she'd been Guy's secretary, or maybe his mistress. Others said she was a prostitute off the streets near Hopkins, or a figment of Guy's imagination, a fictitious character he'd created to hide the true identity of the woman behind the cells. As Helen showed up in articles again and again with different last names, a few scientists began feeling the need to set the record straight. On March 9, 1973, the journal Nature published a letter from Jay Douglas, a biologist at Brunel University. "It is 21 years since George Guy established the famous HeLa cells in culture. It has been estimated that the weight of these cells in the world today exceeds that of the American Negro from whose cervical tumor they originated. That lady has achieved true immortality, both in the test tube and in the hearts and minds of scientists the world over. Since the value of HeLa cells in research, diagnosis, etc., is inestimable. Yet we do not know her name. It has been widely stated that He and La are the first letters of her names, but whereas one textbook says the names were Helen Lane, another says Henrietta Lacks. My letters to the authors, inquiring the source of their information, like the letter to the hospital from which Guy's paper emanated, remain unanswered. Does anyone know for sure? Would it be contrary to medical ethics in the HeLa cell's coming-of-age year to authenticate the name and let He-La enjoy the fame she so richly deserves?" Douglas was flooded with responses. There's no record of readers addressing his question about medical ethics, but they did correct his grammar and his use of the word Negro in place of Negress. Many replies offered the names of women they believed were behind the HeLa cells: Helga Larson, Heather Langtree, even the actress Hedy Lamarr. In a follow-up letter on April 20, 1973, Douglas announced that all those women should withdraw as gracefully as they can, because he'd received a letter from Howard W. Jones that left no doubt that HeLa cells were named after Henrietta Lacks. And Jones wasn't the only one setting the record straight about Henrietta's name. Soon, Victor McCusick, one of Jones's co-authors, would send a similar letter to a reporter from Science, correcting her misuse of the name Helen Lane. In response, the journalist wrote a short follow-up article in Science titled HeLa for Henrietta Lacks. In it, she explained that she'd inadvertently repeated the lore about the origin of those cells. Then, in one of the most widely read science journals in the world, she corrected her error. Helen Lane, it seems, never lived. But Henrietta Lacks did, long protected by the pseudonym Helen Lane. She also reported that Henrietta's tumor had been incorrectly diagnosed. "None of this alters the validity of the work done with HeLa cells," she wrote. "But it may be worth noting, for the record." Part 3. Immortality. Chapter 23. It's Alive. 1973 to 1974. On a hazy day in 1973, in a brown brick row house 5 doors down from her own, Babette Lax sat at her friend Gardenia's dining room table. Gardenia's brother-in-law was in town from Washington, D.C., and they'd all just finished having lunch. As Gardenia clanked dishes in the kitchen, her brother-in-law asked Babette what she did for a living. When she told him she was a patient aide at Baltimore City Hospital, he said, "Really? I work at the National Cancer Institute." They talked about medicine and Gardenia's plants, which covered the windows and counters. "Those things would die in my house," Babette said, and they laughed. "Where are you from, anyway?" he asked. "North Baltimore." "No kidding. Me too. What's your last name?" "Well, it was Cooper, but my married name is Lax."
"Your last name is Lax?"
"Yeah? Why?"
"It's funny," he said. "I've been working with these cells in my lab for years, and I just read this article that said they came from a woman named Henrietta Lax. I've never heard that name anywhere else."
Babette laughed.
"My mother-in-law's Henrietta Lax, but I know you're not talking about her. She's been dead almost 25 years.
"Henrietta Lax is your mother-in-law?" he asked, suddenly excited. "Did she die of cervical cancer?" Babette stopped smiling and snapped, "How'd you know that?"
"Those cells in my lab have to be hers," he said. "They're from a black woman named Henrietta Lax who died of cervical cancer at Hopkins in the 50s.
"What?" Babette yelled, jumping up from her chair. "What do you mean you got her cells in your lab?"
He held his hands up like, "Whoa, wait a minute. I ordered them from a supplier just like everybody else."
"What do you mean, everybody else?" Babette snapped. "What supplier? Who's got cells from my mother-in-law?"
It was like a nightmare. She'd read in the paper about the syphilis study at Tuskegee, which had just been stopped by the government after 40 years. And now, here was Gardenia's brother-in-law saying Hopkins had part of Henrietta alive, and scientists everywhere were doing research on her, and the family had no idea. It was like all those terrifying stories she'd heard about Hopkins her whole life were suddenly true and happening to her.
"If they're doing research on Henrietta," she thought, "it's only a matter of time before they come for Henrietta's children, and maybe her grandchildren."
Gardenia's brother-in-law told Babette that Henrietta's cells had been all over the news lately because they'd been causing problems by contaminating other cultures. But Babette just kept shaking her head and saying,
"How come nobody told her family part of her was still alive?"
"I wish I knew," he said. Like most researchers, he'd never thought about whether the woman behind HeLa cells had given them voluntarily. Babette excused herself and ran home, bursting through the screen door into the kitchen, yelling for Lawrence.
"Part of your mother? It's alive."
Lawrence called his father to tell him what Babette had heard, and Day didn't know what to think.
"Henrietta's alive?" he thought.
It didn't make any sense. He'd seen her body at the funeral and Clover himself. Did they go dig it up? Or maybe they did something to her during that autopsy. Lawrence called the main switchboard at Hopkins, saying,
"I'm calling about my mother, Henrietta Lax. You got some of her alive in there."
When the operator couldn't find a record of a patient named Henrietta Lax in the hospital, Lawrence hung up and didn't know who else to call. Soon after Lawrence called Hopkins, in June 1973, a group of researchers gathered around a table at Yale University at the first international workshop on human gene mapping, a first step toward the Human Genome Project. They were talking about how to stop the HeLa contamination problem, when someone pointed out that the whole mess could be sorted out if they found genetic markers specific to Henrietta and used them to identify which cells were hers and which weren't. But doing that would require DNA samples from her immediate family, preferably her husband as well as her children, to compare their DNA to HeLa's and create a map of Henrietta's genes. Victor McCusick, one of the scientists who'd first published Henrietta's name, happened to be at that table. He told them he could help. Henrietta's husband and children were still patients at Hopkins, he said, so finding them wouldn't be difficult. As a physician on staff, McCusick had access to their medical records and contact information. The geneticists at the conference were thrilled. If they had access to DNA from Henrietta's children, they could not only solve the contamination problem, but also study Henrietta's cells in entirely new ways. McCusick agreed. So he turned to one of his postdoctoral fellows, Susan Hsu, and said, "As soon as you get back to Baltimore, get this done." McCusick didn't give Hsu instructions for explaining the research to the Laxes. All she knew was that Victor McCusick had told her to call the family. "He was like a god," Hsu told me years later. "He was a famous, famous man. He trained most of the other famous medical geneticists in the world. When Dr. McCusick said, 'You go back to Baltimore, get this blood drawn,' I did it." When Hsu got home from the conference, she called Day to ask if she could draw blood from his family. "They said they got my wife and she part alive," he told me years later. "They said they'd been doing experiments on her, and they wanted to come test my children, see if they got that cancer killed their mother." But Hsu hadn't said anything about testing the children for cancer. There was no such thing as a cancer test, and even if there had been, McCusick's lab wouldn't have been doing one because he wasn't a cancer researcher. McCusick was a renowned geneticist who'd founded the world's first human genetics department at Hopkins, where he maintained a catalog of hundreds of genes, including several he'd discovered himself in Amish populations. He compiled information about known genes and the research done on them into a database called Mendelian Inheritance in Man, the Bible of the Field, which now was nearly 20,000 entries and is still growing. McCusick and Hsu were hoping to use somatic cell hybridization to test the Lax family for several different genetic markers, including specific proteins called HLA markers. By testing Henrietta's children, they hoped to find out what Henrietta's HLA markers might have been, so they could use those to identify her cells. Hsu had only recently come to America from China, and English wasn't her native language. According to Hsu, when she called Day in 1973, she told him this: "We come to draw blood to get HLA androgen. We do genetic marker profile because we can deduce a lot of Henrietta Lacks genotype from the children and the husband." When I asked her if Day seemed to understand, Hsu said, "They are very receptive to us when I made phone call. They are pretty intelligent. I think Mr. Lax pretty much already knew that his wife made a contribution and are very aware of the value of HeLa cells. They probably heard people talking that the cell line is such important thing. Everybody talking about HeLa back then. They are very nice family, so they very nicely let us draw blood." Hsu's accent was strong, and so was Day's. He spoke with a southern country drawl so thick his own children often had a hard time understanding him. But language wasn't their only barrier. Day wouldn't have understood the concept of immortal cells or HLA markers coming from anyone, accent or not. He'd only gone to school for 4 years of his life, and he'd never studied science. The only kind of cell he'd heard of was the kind Zakaria was living in out at Hagerstown. So he did what he'd always done when he didn't understand something a doctor said. He nodded and said yes. Years later, when I asked McCusick if anyone had tried to get informed consent from the Lax family, he said,
I suspect there was no effort to explain anything in great detail, but I don't believe anyone would have told them they were testing for cancer because that wasn't the case. They would have just said, your mother had cancer. The cells from that cancer have been growing all over the place and studied in great detail. In order to understand that better, we would like to have that blood from you people.
When I asked Susan Chu the same question, she said,
no, we never gave consent form because you just go to draw blood. We are not doing some kind of medical research, you know? Not long term. All we wanted is a few tubes of blood and to do genetic marker test. It's not involved in a human research committee or things like that.
Although this attitude wasn't uncommon at the time, NIH guidelines stipulated that all human subject research funded by NIH, as McCusick's was, required both informed consent and approval from a Hopkins review board. Those guidelines had been implemented in 1966, in the aftermath of the Southam trial, and then expanded to include a detailed definition of informed consent in 1971. They were still in the process of being codified into law when Chu called Day. McCusick began his research on the Lax family at a time of great flux in research oversight. Just 1 year earlier, in response to Tuskegee and several other unethical studies, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW, had launched an investigation into federal oversight of human subject research and found it to be inadequate. As one government report said, it was a time filled with widespread confusion about how to assess risk, as well as refusal by some researchers to cooperate with oversight, and indifference by those charged with administering research and its rules at local institutions. After halting the Tuskegee study, Chu proposed new protection of human subjects regulations that would require, among other things, informed consent. A notice inviting public comment on that proposed new law would be published in the Federal Register in October 1973, just a few months after Chu called Day. After Day got off the phone with Chu, he called Lawrence, Sonny, and Deborah, saying,
you got to come over to the house tomorrow. Doctors from Hopkins coming to test everybody's blood to see if you all got that cancer your mother had.
When Henrietta died, Day had agreed to let her doctors do an autopsy because they'd told him it might help his children someday. They must have been telling the truth, Day thought. Zakaria was in Henrietta's womb when she first got the cancer, and he'd had all those anger problems ever since. Now, Deborah was almost 24, not much younger than Henrietta had been when she died. It made sense they were calling to say it was time for her to get tested. Deborah panicked. She knew her mother had gotten sick at 30, so she'd long feared her own 30th birthday, figuring that whatever happened to her mother at that age would happen to her, too. And Deborah couldn't stand the idea of her own children growing up motherless like she had. At that point, LaTanya was 2, Alfred was 6, and Cheetah had never paid child support. Deborah had tried welfare for 3 months but hated it. So now she was working days at a suburban Toys R Us that took more than an hour and 3 buses to get to, then nights at a hamburger place called Gino's behind her apartment. Since Deborah couldn't afford a babysitter, her boss at Gino's let Tonya and Alfred sit in the corner of the restaurant at night while Deborah worked. On her 8:30 dinner break, Deborah would run behind the building to her apartment and put the children to bed. They knew not to open the door unless they heard her secret knock, and they never put the kerosene lamps near a curtain or blanket. Deborah practiced fire drills with them in case something went wrong while she was at work, teaching them to crawl to the window, throw out a sheet rope she kept tied to the bed leg, and climb to safety. Those children were all Deborah had, and she wasn't going to let anything happen to them. So when her father called saying Hopkins wanted to test to see if she had her mother's cancer, Deborah sobbed, saying, "Lord, don't take me away from my babies. Not now. Not after everything we've been through." A few days after Susan Chu's phone call, Day, Sonny, Lawrence, and Deborah all sat around Lawrence's dining room table as Chu and a doctor from McCusick's lab collected tubes of blood from each of them. For the next several days, Deborah called Hopkins again and again, telling the switchboard operators, "I'm calling for my cancer results." But none of the operators knew what tests she was talking about or where to send her for help. Soon, Chu wrote a letter to Lawrence asking if she could send a nurse out to Hagerstown to collect samples from Zakaria in prison. She included a copy of the George Guy tribute written by McCusick and Jones, saying she thought Lawrence would like to see an article about his mother's cells. No one in the family remembers reading that article. They figure Lawrence just put it in a drawer and forgot about it. The Lax men didn't think much about their mother's cells or the cancer tests. Lawrence was working full-time on the railroad and living in a house filled with children. Zakaria was still in jail. And times had gotten tough for Sonny, who was now busy selling drugs. But Deborah couldn't stop worrying. She was terrified that she might have cancer and consumed with the idea that researchers had done and were perhaps still doing horrible things to her mother. She'd heard the stories about Hopkins snatching black people for research, and she'd read an article in JED about the Tuskegee study that suggested doctors might have actually injected those men with syphilis in order to study them. The injection of disease-causing organisms into unaware human subjects has occurred before in American medical science, the article explained. It was done 8 years ago in New York City by Dr. Chester Southam, a cancer specialist who injected live cancer cells into chronically ill elderly patients. Deborah started wondering if, instead of testing the Lax children for cancer, McCusick and Chu were actually injecting them with the same bad blood that had killed their mother. She started asking Day a lot of questions about Henrietta. How'd she get sick? What happened when she died? What did those doctors do to her? The answers seemed to confirm her fears. Day told her that Henrietta hadn't seemed sick at all. He said he took her into Hopkins, they started doing treatments, then her stomach turned black as coal and she died. Sadie said the same thing, and so did all the other cousins. But when she asked what kind of cancer her mother had, what treatments the doctor gave her, and what part of her was still alive, the family had no answers. So when one of McCusick's assistants called Deborah and asked her to come into Hopkins to give more blood, she went, thinking that if her family couldn't answer questions about her mother, maybe the scientists could. She didn't know the blood was for a researcher in California who wanted some samples for his own HeLa research, and she didn't know why McCusick's assistant was calling her and not her brothers. She figured it was because the problem her mother had didn't affect boys. She still thought she was being tested for cancer. Deborah went into McCusick's office to give more blood on June 26, 1974, 4 days before the new federal law went into effect requiring IRB approval and informed consent for all federally funded research. The new law, published in the Federal Register 1 month earlier, applied to all subjects at risk, meaning any individual who may be exposed to the possibility of injury, including physical, psychological, or social injury, as a consequence of participation as a subject. But what constituted injury and risk was heavily debated. Numerous researchers had appealed to Hu, asking that collection of blood and tissues be exempt from the new law. After all, doctors had been drawing blood for centuries for diagnostic testing, and aside from the pain of a needle stick, There seemed to be no risk. But Hugh did not exempt those procedures. In fact, it later clarified the law to specifically include them. McCusick's research on the Lacks family coincided with the beginning of a new era of genetic research, in which the concept of risk to patients would change completely. With the ability to identify genes from a blood sample or even a single cell, the risk of a blood draw was no longer just a minor infection or the pain of a needle stick. It was that someone could uncover your genetic information. It was about violation of privacy. Deborah met McCusick only once, when she went into Hopkins to give blood. He shook her hand and said that Henrietta had made an important contribution to science. Then Deborah bombarded him with questions. What made her mother sick? How was part of her still living? What did that mean? What did Henrietta do for science? And did all those blood tests he was doing mean Deborah was going to die young like her mother? McCusick did not explain why he was having someone draw blood from Deborah. Instead, he told her about Henrietta's cells being used for the polio vaccine and genetic research. He said they'd gone up in early space missions and been used in atomic bomb testing. Deborah heard those things and imagined her mother on the moon and being blown up by bombs. She was terrified and couldn't stop wondering if the parts of her mother they were using in research could actually feel the things scientists were doing to them. When she asked McCusick to explain more about the cells, he gave her a book he'd edited called Medical Genetics, which would become one of the most important textbooks in the field. He said it would tell her everything she needed to know, then autographed the inside front cover. Beneath his signature, he wrote a phone number and told her to use it for making appointments to give more blood. McCusick flipped to the second page of the introduction. There, between graphs of disease-specific infant mortality and a description of the homozygous state of Garrodian inborn errors, was the photograph of Henrietta with her hands on her hips. He pointed to the paragraph that mentioned her. Parenthetically, medical geneticists making use of the study of cells in place of the whole patient have cashed in on a reservoir of morphologic, biochemical, and other information in cell biology derived in no small part from study of the famous cell line cultured from the patient pictured on this page, Henrietta Lacks. The book was filled with complicated sentences explaining Henrietta's cells by saying, "Its atypical histology may correlate with the unusually malignant behavior of the carcinoma, and something about the correlate of the tumor's singularity." Reading magazines took Deborah a long time, because she had to stop often to look words up in her dictionary. Now, she sat in the clinic, gripping McCusick's book, not even trying to read the words. All she could think was that she'd never seen that photograph of her mother before. What happened to her to make her end up in there? She wondered. And how did he get that picture? Day swore he'd never given it to McCusick or any of Henrietta's doctors. Deborah's brothers swore they hadn't either. The only thing Day could figure was that maybe Howard Jones had asked Henrietta for a picture, then stuck it in her medical record. But as far as Day knew, no one had ever asked permission to publish it. When I talked to McCusick several years before his death in 2008, he was 79 and still conducting research and training young scientists. He didn't recall where he'd gotten the photo, but he imagined Henrietta's family must have given it to Howard Jones or another doctor at Hopkins. Though McCusick remembered the research he conducted on the Lacks family, he didn't remember meeting Deborah or giving her his book, and said he'd never had first-hand contact with the family. He'd left that up to Hsu. When I talked to Susan Hsu, now a director of medical genetics at the American Red Cross, she told me that working with McCusick on HeLa cells was a highlight of her career. "I'm very proud," she told me. "I probably will Xerox these pages and tell my kids this is important." But when I explained to her that the Laxes thought she was testing them for cancer, and that they were upset about scientists using the cells without their knowledge, she was shocked. "I feel very bad," she said. "People should have told them. You know, we never thought at that time they did not understand." She also told me she had a message she hoped I'd give to the Lax family when I talked with them next. "Just tell them I'm really grateful," she said. "They should be very proud of the mother or the wife. I think that if they are angry, probably they didn't realize how famous the cells are now in the world. It's an unfortunate thing what happened. They still should be very proud. Their mother will never die as long as the medical science is around. She will always be such a famous thing." Toward the end of our conversation, Shu mentioned that she could learn much more from testing the family's blood today, since DNA technology had advanced so much since the 70s. Then she asked if I'd tell the Lax family one more thing for her. "If they are willing," she said, "I wouldn't mind to go back and get some more blood." Chapter 24. Least They Can Do. 1975. The Laxes didn't know anything about the HeLa contamination problem that led McCusick and Shu to them until Michael Rogers, a young reporter for Rolling Stone, showed up at their house with long hair and rock and roll clothes. Rogers was something of a journalism prodigy. By his 19th birthday, he'd gotten a degree in creative writing and physics and published his first story in Esquire. By his early 20s, when he started looking into the HeLa story, he'd already published 2 books and joined the staff of Rolling Stone. In coming years, he'd go on to be an editor at Newsweek and later The Washington Post. Rogers first learned about HeLa cells after seeing Helen Lane Lives, written over a urinal in a medical school bathroom. He started reading news reports about HeLa cells and the contamination problem and realized it would make a great story for Rolling Stone. The perfect mix of science and human interest. So Rogers set out to find this mysterious Helen Lane. He called Margaret Guy, who was friendly and talkative until Rogers asked about Helen Lane. Then she told him it wouldn't be a good idea for them to meet and hung up. Eventually, Rogers found his way to Walter Nelson Reese, who mentioned, as an aside, that Henrietta Lacks was the real name of the woman behind the cells. Soon, while sitting on his Baltimore hotel bed with the view of the Bromo Seltzer clock, Rogers found Lawrence Lacks in the phone book. It was the winter of 1975. The streets were icy, and on his way to Lawrence's house, Rogers's taxi was hit by another car in the middle of an intersection. The cab spun in the road, doing 5, then 6 full circles, as if some giant hand had reached down and spun it like a bottle. Rogers had done risky reporting all over the world. Now he was sitting in the back of a cab, gripping the door handle, thinking, "Damn it, it would be really stupid if I got killed in Baltimore working on this of all assignments. It's not even a dangerous story." Decades later, as I talked with Rogers in his Brooklyn apartment, we agreed, only half-joking, that the spinning cab was probably no accident. Deborah would later say that it was Henrietta warning him to leave her family alone because he was about to tell them something upsetting. She'd also say that Henrietta started the famous Oakland, California fire that later burned Rogers's house, destroying all the notes and documents he'd collected about HeLa and Henrietta's family. When Rogers made it to Lawrence's house, he expected to interview the Laxes about Henrietta, but found himself bombarded with questions instead. "It was so clear they hadn't been treated well," Rogers told me. "They truly had no idea what was going on, and they really wanted to understand. But doctors just took blood samples without explaining anything and left the family worrying." Lawrence asked, "What I was wondering was, about these cells, they say they're stronger, they're taking over. Is that bad or good? Does that mean if we get sick, we'll live longer?" Rogers told the Laxes that no, The cells being immortal didn't mean they'd become immortal too, or that they'd die of cancer. But he wasn't sure they believed him. He explained the concept of cells as best he could, told them about the media reports that had already appeared about Gila.